Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I'll be discussing value practices in the life sciences and medicine. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm going to be talking about an edited collection, which has been published by Oxford University Press this year, called Value Practices in the Life Sciences and Medicine. It's edited by three researchers, Isabel Dusage, Klaus Frederick Helgeson, and Francis Lee. The three of them started this project at Linköping University in Sweden, but Isabel has now moved to Uppsala to be a researcher at the Centre for Gender Research. So, hello.
Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Good. You can hear me all okay. If we could kick off by maybe the three of you briefly introducing yourselves to the listeners, and then perhaps we'll start talking about this broader question of value.
All right. I can start shortly. My name is Isabel Dusage, and I am a researcher based at the Center for Gender Research in Uppsala University. I come from the history of science, technology, and medicine, and the research I've been conducting lately has been mostly dealing with the neurosciences of sexuality and gender. Before that, I've been interested in issues of medical visualization and visual culture and the computerization of healthcare from a range of different perspectives.
Okay, hi, I'm Klaus Frederick, or CF for short. So I'm a professor at Technology and Social Change in Linköping, Sweden. My background is in business studies, but I have, even my PhD student years worked at the intersection between science and technology studies and economic sociology, first in my dissertation on the telecommunications industry, and since around 15 years in the area of healthcare governance, medical research, and so on. So, that's where I am.
Yeah. And, I'm Francis Lee. I'm working, my background is in a field called technology and social change, which is a specific subject here in Sweden. And I've been working on the intersection of technology and social change and life science for the past few years. I've written about the large-scale biosciences and large-scale protein mapping projects, looking at how proteins are expressed in the human body. And I'm interested in, I think my main interest is in how technology and science and knowledge production are intertwined with politics. I'm also interested in, for example, digital technologies and how digital technologies become valuation machines, how they produce and are used to make values in different settings.
That's quite a good place to contextualize the book, I think, this question of making values. So I'd be interested to kind of hear a bit about why value and values have become such an important topic in social science in recent years.
I think in general that values are an important way to look at human matters, because values lie at the heart of any human decision making. And values are at the same time social and cultural and emotional, yet they are performed by individuals in specific situations, in specific contexts. So values give us key to understand human conflicts and dilemmas in ways that are quite unique, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that would be, there's so many empirical reasons why it's important to study values, because people struggle with values in many areas. But I think, also from a theoretical point of view, it's important because the very large traditional ways of understanding values have often taken them as kind of the cause for action, for instance. And apparently, when we look at in many settings, I think that people actually are struggling with what is important here, and therefore there seems to be a need for other approaches to understand and appreciate values as an empirical phenomenon. And I think that's also part of why it's important to study it.
Hmm. For me, I think the heart of the matter lies in that values are at the heart of politics, of making what is important in society. I mean, what should count? How should it count? How should we measure what counts, and so on? I mean, it's about making what matters in the world. And as a kind of consequence of this making of importance and mattering is also the making of what does not count. I mean, what is made invisible, what is made not valuable, how do we make non-value? So, I mean, I think values is a topic that we can't really escape if we want to grapple with how important this is made in society.
The book kind of explores this through a series of case studies, but before we discuss the individual chapters, I think it'd be worth saying a little bit more about the kind of the context setting that comes in the opening chapter, the opening essay of the book, where you draw that question of, you know, how a non-value is created, how do values work in practice really, really clearly, I think. And there's a couple of things I'd like to hear about. And one is is why it is you've decided to ask the question how something comes to count as value and how other things are kind of not counted as values. Why you've started from that question, and what are the consequences for research when we think about values in those ways?
Okay, it's a very big question, and I think we can have several different answers to that one. But one starting bit, I think that, I mean, coming back to what I said about, I mean, we were not felt totally comfortable with this. I mean, many major ways to understand, theoretical ways to understand values, and that way open up for making it more, I mean, open for empirical study, how people grapple with values. And I mean, one way to see this, if you take science and technology studies kind of view on it, is what would it mean to do with values what sociology of scientific knowledge did with knowledge 10, 20, 30 years ago, when they asked the question, what comes to count as scientific knowledge? I mean, that kind of approach, I mean, in very broad terms, I mean, and taking that kind of attitude, but not focusing on the epistemic side, but more on the values side.
Yeah, I think one interesting aspect of going into values is traditionally values are often seen as drivers of human action. I mean, we have all these studies going into what values people have and how we should develop politics or how the world should be shaped in relation to the values that people have. But that kind of misses the point, according to our approach, and hides how people grapple with making values, struggle with how they should relate to the values that other people express, or how they make values for different devices. So rather than seeing values as driving human action, we see humans as being in the driver's seat and producing different types of values and grappling with them in practice.
And I think for me, there is an aspect of asking the question of values that helps us understand what that helps us understand the desirability of certain scientific knowledge. Having been studying the relation between biology and feminism for the last years, I've been wondering why certain scientific theories seem to be more popular than others, be they more quite conservative in terms of worldview or gender views, for example, or they're more radical. And I believe that the asking questions of values may help us understand why certain kinds of knowledge is considered valuable. Why is neuroscientific knowledge of the human, for example, considered a valuable resource to understand human action? Why is biological knowledge considered a valuable way to understand society or societal problems? Those questions are very big, and the book does not aim to understand to answer them specifically. But that is one corner I come from, so to speak. I think asking the question of values, how certain kinds of knowledge comes to count as valuable, what it is worth, for whom, for what purposes, help us understand better the place of knowledge and technological interventions in the world.
The other thing the book does, which is an important aspect of academic writing, is kind of mark itself out from what it's not or from what it's moving beyond. And the two perspectives you situate the book in relation to in the introduction are a moral economy perspective and a biocapital perspective on value. And I'm interested to know how the book relates to, but also move beyond these two current approaches.
Okay, I can start that one. So, I mean, how should you say that we are in a friendly but critical conversation with those two perspectives that you mentioned in the introductory chapter and in several instances of the book. And actually, to be fair, I mean, the workshop that kicked this book project off was called the Moral Economist in the Life Sciences or something like that. So that perspective was there along, because coming to our concerns, we were interested in how values are enacted in life sciences. And then, of course, the moral economy perspective is a touching stone. But also, as we write in the introduction chapter, we find that there are both those perspectives highlight very important aspects of medicine and life science, but at the same time, they sometimes are a bit static in what are the values of something or out there, and does not fully open up, we think, for empirical scrutiny, the enactment, ordering, and displacement of values, something like that. So, I mean, a critical but friendly, or friendly but critical conversation with those two perspectives. We think that we could go further in problematizing the value practices in medicine and life science by going beyond those two perspectives.
I can say a few words about what I think those perspectives give us, what they help us see. I think the moral economy perspective is very important in making visible that scientific practices, but also other practices in healthcare and medicine, are profoundly shaped by cultural norms and codes of conduct and understandings of what is good and what is not good, what is important and what is not. So I think the moral economy perspective is what got us started in thinking in those ways, although we felt the need to go further than that, as CF was describing. And I think from the biocapital literature, we get this very important point that some kind of value or some kinds of values are being produced in the also mundane practices of both science and healthcare and medicine, and that this production of values follows, that is not at, totally at random. It has some kind of organization or some kind of patterns, and that those are worth studying. And this is why we relate, I think, to these two bodies of theory and research, is that they point out very important considerations about the existence of values in the fields we study.
Yeah, I think the work of Lorraine Daston has been a touchstone for us, as you, I think you guys should see it. And I mean, she's writing about the virtuous scientist and the virtues of science. So she looks at what kind of characteristics a scientist should have to be a good scientist, or what type of characteristics a good science should have, for example, objectivity or something like that. What is virtuous science? While the biocapital literature looks at how often how economy corrupts the biosciences, and looks at how economy is is infiltrated or is intertwined with scientific work, and how economic forces shape science into something. There's an undertone of looking at how economy reshapes science into something that it shouldn't be. And we think that these perspectives have very, very valuable insights, but we think that they kind of stop short of actually looking at the performance of value, because, I mean, economy, the economic value of the life sciences is made in practices, and the valuation of and production of what is a virtuous scientist is also made in practice. And we think that these kind of perspectives, they kind of create a static arena for looking at how they reshape something, rather than looking at how actual scientists struggle with them in everyday work, because they do. I mean, as several chapters in the book highlight, we have KOLs struggling with how to work for the pharmaceutical industry while upholding their oath to the medical profession and so on. So, or scientists that create companies but still want to work for the human good. I mean, it's a constant struggle for people in the life sciences and in medicine to kind of grapple with the values. So, I mean, look, us to come into this struggle with predefined notions of what values are is what we think these perspectives miss.
Understanding the, I guess, the kind of the boundary making around particular elements of good science or bad science, or appropriate or inappropriate behaviours, is absolutely crucial. But as you say, going into it with kind of fixed perspectives on what those values are misses the way values are created, almost kind of in motion and a dynamic. And the book deals with this in four different ways, I think, by thinking about conflicts, thinking about markets, thinking about bodies, and thinking about knowledge. And I wonder if we could take the four sections in turn with maybe perhaps one, perhaps two examples from the chapters in each four sections. So if we begin with what are the sort of boundaries of acceptable behaviour for the life sciences, whether it's to do with people who lead opinions, the boundaries between medicine and the pharmaceuticals historically, or in terms of how the biochemist works.
Well, I mean, the question, I mean, you sent us some questions before this recording, and you phrased the question, what are the boundaries of acceptable behavior in the life sciences? And it's interesting because we are always faced with the same question anyway. What are values? What are something? It's an ontological question about how things are in the world. And I think perhaps what we were trying to emphasize also in relation to the biocapital literature and how things are made and remade in practice. So in the question of KOLs, then, like these key opinion leaders that Sergio Sismondo is writing about in the book, the pharmaceutical industry pays doctors to go and represent them at different talks and in different key spaces in relation to how to get people to prescribe their pharmaceutical stuffs. So what we're interested in, or what Sergio is writing about, is how this is a constant struggle then in trying to negotiate different types of moral boundaries or economic boundaries that are in place, but they're constantly shifting and made. So, for example, how can a KOL reconcile working for the pharmaceutical industry while still trying to uphold being an objective scientist in some cases, or being a good physician in other cases? So he's writing about how these KOLs, key opinion leaders, try to reconcile different value systems and make the boundaries between these different value systems. And it's a process that is both emotionally and economically difficult for them. So they try to kind of use different types of arguments to reconcile their own conscience, in some cases, towards their payment and so on. And the same goes for the Sven Wiedemann's case in the book, where he writes about plagiarism, a historical case where there's a discussion about what is plagiarism and publication priority, who gets the priority in terms of who published first. And this is also then a negotiation between different key leaders in the field that he's studying. What is acceptable behavior? It's not clear cut. It's not laid down in a law. And even if there are kind of codes of conduct, it's a constant matter of negotiation. So what we would like to say, though, then, rather than looking at what the boundaries of acceptable behavior are in the life sciences, the ontological kind of statement, we would like to look at the performative statement and look at how are boundaries of acceptable behavior made by different actors.
So how does this work for markets?
Okay, so the book has a section, I think it's called The Markets for as Carrier for Health or something like that. Mm-hmm. And there's three distinct different studies for different areas in that section. And I think that all three contributions to that section clearly shows how efforts to work with more kind of markets ways of ordering involves, I mean, many difficult questions for those involved in, I mean, what should count when making this into a more market-based approach for provision of healthcare, for instance, like in the study about the Netherlands healthcare system by Ten Zyder and Girac and colleagues, or for creating a market for the development of malaria vaccine as described by Daniel Neyland and Elena Semakova, or indeed when, I mean, making a system for allocating organs, transplant organs in the UK, which is a study by Philip Roscoe from St. Andrews. I mean, and all these three chapters show how the efforts to develop or making a market more market-like system for doing, engaging with healthcare also surfaces a lot of grappling with values. But I think also another kind of broad takeaway message from this section is, of course, that, I mean, it's not the market solutions or the market modes of ordering that create the struggle to enact an order and displace many different values. I mean, the many different values would be at stake anyway, but maybe it is the kind of the market initiatives reshapes the problem in a specific way, and maybe also makes them even more kind of salient, but or visible, especially if they're, I mean, as all these three cases are cases where things are not fully black boxed yet, so they are very kind of the value conflicts are very articulate, and people are working with how to distinguish and how to define what should count as a fair system for allocating organs, or what should count as efficient way to allocate organs, of course. So but I wouldn't say that those kind of questions would be absent if you would have a completely non-market way of ordering things. But I mean, market becomes an intervention, if you would like, that produces a lot of work or value practice in dealing with the value problems. And I think that all three chapters, as I mentioned in the section, very clearly shows how. So I mean, market reforms seems to be a very interesting site to look at the creation of stakes, the ordering of values, and of course also figuring out the relations between the epistemic and the values and so on. Yeah, so I think that's a broad message from these three chapters in that section.
The process of ordering you were talking about is really crucial when we're thinking about lives being counted as valuable or actually not counted as valuable. And the third section has got three chapters that engage with this in terms of living beings, whether kind of genetically developed or created, or in terms of things like prenatal screening during pregnancy. So I wonder if you could talk about that kind of process from these three chapters.
Yes, the three chapters in that section of the book deal with pretty different cases. Shortly, one of them by Kristin Astdal is about the attempt to create and market a new form of fish, the fresh cod. And the whole chapter is about the necessity to create new market devices and policy instruments and to alter life forms, this life cycle of the fish, in order to make it possible to create a product that can be advertised for and consumed in certain manners. This chapter is very much about how these different sets of values, how different sets of values are entangled and worked with by the people involved in different positions. It's all both about biotechnological, agricultural innovation, and several other levels of practice. And this is about adapting organisms, their conditions of life, and markets to each other, I would say. Another chapter by Kerry Fries addresses what zoos deal with after leaving an economy of hunting and gathering. Zoos have been repositioning themselves as promoters of biological diversity by making animals in the zoo through biotechnological interventions such as cloning of species. And there the questions or dilemmas arise as of which animals should be saved or should be preserved, which species should be invested in, on which basis, and the struggles about these different principles. So this is about notions of genetic value and different notions of genetic value and genetic diversity and different concepts for zoos. Ilana Lovis' chapter deals with the prenatal diagnosis, and it shows, so now we're moving to speaking about human lives. And Lovey deals with how prenatal PNDs, prenatal diagnostic technologies, were transformed into a routine diagnosis historically, in France and in Western countries. And this refers to refers to a cluster of techniques that provide information on the fetus, and they were historically promoted for the detection of Down syndrome, and with emphasis on women's choices, building on pregnant women's concern for the best of the children. But what the author shows there is that PND and its generalization, its routinization as a procedure, has been more shaped by the health professionals' values than by pregnant women's. This means that an emphasis on epidemiological concerns and ways of thinking, health economic considerations related to those, were more decisive in the way these technologies were shaped, implemented, whereas the end users, we can see women here, had little input on the content of the tests or the availability or the conditions of use. So these three chapters obviously deal with very different kinds of considerations on life and bodies, but what they highlight is that lives and living bodies acquires worth within very specific systems of values that are shaped by professional values, by politics, by ethics, and by, I want to say, a history of professional values as well, and political histories. I'll stop there, I think.
Cool. The last section of the book is where your three respective chapters come together. And I suppose we might contrast the last section of the book being about knowledge, being about practices in labs, being about almost sort of scientific disciplines in the case of something like neuroscience, with the previous section on bodies and living beings. But they do have overlaps and continuities. So I wonder if you could talk me through the last section of the book.
Sure. I'll start with my chapter, cool. Which is about a large-scale mapping project in Sweden, where scientists are seeking funding for mapping all proteins expressed by the genome in the human body. And what I found interesting in looking at this process of seeking funding, of creating such a large-scale bioscience project of mapping thousands of proteins in the body, was how two different kind of produced two different ideas about science and industry relations, about science and industry, how they should work together, how they exist together. And coming to this case and looking at these different science foundations, it's Wellcome Trust, the British foundation, and a Swedish foundation called the Wallenberg, Knut and Alice Wallenberg Foundation. I thought it was interesting to think about how kind of critical approaches to studying science-industry relations and how these kind of prescriptive ideas about triple helix, creating a science-industry nexus, like Silicon Valley, for example, how they kind of have mirror images of what the world of science and industry is. So we have like an idea both in politics, in critical studies of science-industry relations, and in prescriptive studies of science-industry relations that presupposes that there is a boundary between science and industry and that it has specific values tied to this boundary, which values should be on which side of the boundary. And I think what's interesting is when you take a valuographic approach to looking at this boundary is look at how, rather than looking at how this boundary is transgressed or how it should be organized. It's interesting to look at how this boundary is made and remade in negotiations, for example, with science foundations, and how these negotiations about how science and the industry should work together, how they have very large consequences for what good science is made out to be. So, I mean, the consequences of looking at the construction of the boundary between science and industry is that we get an understanding of different value systems that are put in play in science and in industry. And if we look at this specific case that I studied then, the Human Protein Atlas, which produces millions of beautiful images of protein locations in the human body, we can see how two different ideas about what a map of all the human proteins in the body, how two different ideas of this map emerge. And one idea is how it becomes like a treasure map almost. The terrain is not so interesting. It's only the route to the X on the map that's interesting. Only features that lead to the X on the map are interesting. So which makes the map almost, I mean, the features that are not interesting for finding the X are almost invisible. So the proteins that are not a map to a treasure in form of a pharmaceutical concoction or something like that, a medicine or a molecule that can create diagnosis, those proteins are not interesting at all to investigate. It's a very particular idea about what science should do and how to go about this type of science. The other side of this map would be then a topographical map, which the Wellcome Trust kind of wanted the project to be, was a map that could be used by the scientific community at large. And that kind of ontological idea about mapping the protein in the human body creates a completely different understanding of what knowledge is valuable. Then it's all knowledge, all the understanding of different proteins and how they interact or how they don't interact becomes valuable. So we have completely different sets of values being put in play with very large consequences for the scientific work in the lab. So, for example, in the project was eventually founded as a treasure map then, and this created valuation of certain types of methods and certain types of molecules in the laboratory. So the idea about which relations science or industry should have also kind of filters down into the vials and the practices in the lab and the machines and how they were organized in the lab. So we have these large-scale ideas about how science and industry should relate to each other, which then filter down into different valuations of, in this case, it's antibodies. So I think by then moving beyond this presupposed boundary of science-industry relations, we can kind of open up for a field of understanding kind of the negotiations and the effects of these larger ideas about lab in the lab and what molecules, what knowledges, what kind of science should we be organizing. And I think the more interesting question is not going in there and saying economy corrupts science completely or that to say that economy is needed to create a forward momentum in society and science is part of that. I mean, it's more complex than that. And by kind of taking a step back and not presupposing this analytical division, we can get a hold of a whole new set of problems and a whole new set of value enactments in the life sciences.
That idea of a new set of problems and a new set of value enactments is a good place to start to conclude, I think, because one of the things that comes up in the final chapter of the book is the idea of valuography, and is one of the ways you think through how we might be able to go beyond the life sciences and medicine and start to think about other areas of the social world with this performative and enacting sort of starting point that you have in the book?
Yeah, so to be honest, it's always a struggle to conclude these kind of books. I mean, and also, I mean, how do you draw together? I mean, the many insights you can get from the contributions, quite some of the effort in doing the book was in this final chapter, and we landed on, I mean, not of course ending. We didn't want to end in what values are at stake in the life sciences and medicine, because that would kind of fail the whole project.
Yeah, but defeat these purposes.
So and then we thought, what can we learn from the chapters in ways to understand or investigate the value practices, and. We built from that. So, I mean, that's what, when we coined the term valuography as the kind of an empirical oriented research program to study the enactment, ordering, and displacing of values. And of course, how can we draw insights in approaches from the different chapters? And we should say here that the idea of valuography, it draws on a tradition of coining terms like Peter Deer, he coined the term epistemography, I mean, the empirical study of what comes to count as knowledge, or Michael Lynch has suggested ethiography for the study of the practices around what comes as ethics, and Steve Wolger has suggested technography along the same lines, I mean, the empirical study of technology and so on. So then valuography, then, of course, using as a label then for a pragmatic practice-based approach for the study of values and their enactment and so on. And so what we do there in the final chapter is to see and kind of tease out the strategies that we have seen in the different chapters, chapter contributions, in how to see, to make visible the values at stake and the enactment and ordering of values and so on. So chapters work with questions of compensation. It seems to be a very kind of often heated kind of area, and therefore many values are articulated and organized and so on. Studying devices and that's a clear example that would be Philip Roscoe's chapter on devices for allocating organs. I mean, studying devices and their construction, and because there many of the different values at stake become very, very articulated and so on. Controversies more generally as another kind of approach. Tracing over time that values are not stable over time, and the chapter by Ilana Levy that Issa mentioned previously is a very different settings. So, I mean, I would say it's more of a beginning than an end. Of course, it's a conclusion of the book, but we could see that there's so much more you could develop with how to develop a valuographic research program. We saw that there seems to be some kind of methodological tactics or strategies that you can further develop, of course, but draw on. And we also see that it can be put to use for different purposes, like, for instance, working with different concerns you have, and also maybe even intervene and so on. So that's the kind of ideas we have for the valuographic research program.
And the program has an associated journal now?
Not, I mean, you're thinking about the valuation studies. I mean, valuation studies, I would say, is a journal that ties to the idea of valuography, of course, but the valuation studies is more focused on valuation as a set of practices that take place in many different places. I mean, far beyond life sciences, of course, we have grading of students, we have pricing of houses and all that kind of stuff. So you could say that studying valuation as a practice is a valuographic tactic, so to say. So valuation studies focuses on one kind of valuographic tactics for studying the enactment of values. But on another angle, of course, a journal has to have a much more eclectic and broader audience. So that, I mean, there would be maybe, I mean, of course, there are contributions in the Journal of Valuation Studies that are not pragmatist, because that's not the kind of necessary condition for studying valuation practices. But I would say that the valuographic approach, as we describe it in the final chapter, is clearly a pragmatist approach to the study of values.
And will there be future collected editions or books for the valuographic approach?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. One upshot from this volume could be said to be an algorithm network. The studies of social studies of algorithms has kind of come out of this collaboration. We have lots of the authors in the book and other members of this. And the point of this network is to look at algorithms as machines of valuation in society, looking at how algorithms interface with, for example, an organ allocation that Philip Roscoe has written about, how algorithms interface with, for example, public health, in the surveillance outbreaks of disease outbreaks. This field is moving more and more towards automatic algorithmic surveillance of how disease is spread and so on. And so we have how algorithms interface with different parts of the social. Also, we have people looking at how algorithms at the tax agency select who should be audited and so on. So, I mean, looking at algorithms can be one inroads and one thing that we're working with to develop the study of valuations in society, looking at how technical apparatus is kind of embodied certain ideas about what is important, what is valuable, and so on.
I could also mention another thing. I mean, Francis and I, we had a project that started around the same time as we set out to do this collaborative book project. And it's a project about the valuations done when designing medical experiments. And the question we are interested in is when people do design for a medical experiment, they have to decide upon what kind of knowledge is worth pursuing and what kind of knowledge is not worth pursuing, what stones is worth turning and what stones to leave lying, so to say. And that project has kind of worked in parallel with the project. There's no empirics in this volume from that project, but we are working on a book on that project. And it will, come out, and it will, of course, clearly be a kind of a valuographic study of medical design as a practice where many values are at stake and people doing the designing of medical experiments have to sort and enact. What should count here? So that's kind of, I wouldn't say an upshot because it's a kind of more of a twin, but a somewhat younger twin because it's not kind of to full fruition yet. So,
and on my side, there are two projects I've been thinking of pursuing where I think the evaluative approach might be enlightening. One of them is deals with the question of the neuroculture of violence and aggression. So issues of there will be a study of people living with issues of aggression and with neurodiagnosis of different sorts, and values might be a way to approach the dilemmas and conflicts and the interface between lay persons and patients and professionals in fruitful ways. Another very different alley is a project I've been considering for a long time, in which I think a valuographic approach would be very fruitful. That would be for kind of political history of health screenings and health registers in Sweden, that gets close to what Francis was talking about, I think, about the algorithms and the computerizations of healthcare. Anyway, there, I think the value approach will be interesting to use as a tool for historical investigation. So, I mean, it has been done in some ways with, for example, notions of moral economies, but I think it will be an interesting theoretical way to get into maybe well-known not always empirically well-known, but otherwise well-known kinds of questions or historical developments in the modern or late modern states in terms of healthcare and the way it relates to power and population. Yes, what triggered me in the Swedish context there was a poster by the left-wing party, I think, in the 70s, which was called Health Screenings for All, as a political peril in a demonstration. And that has spurred me to think in terms of, you know, what, why would you value something so much as part of a political movement as to proclaim it being a common good? There's something fairly exotic about picking just health controls as a political peril, seen from today's, with today's gaze.
That sounds absolutely fascinating and incredibly eclectic as well, I guess, reflecting the core themes, but also the range of essays and chapters that are in the book.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory, where we're discussing value practices in the life sciences and medicine, which is published by Oxford University Press in 2000.